If you've never heard of leishmaniasis or Chagas disease or African trypanosomiasis, you can consider yourself very lucky. These three parasitic diseases are virtually unheard of in America. But taken together, these diseases infect 30 million people each year, according to the World Health Organization. Most of those affected are in developing countries, where access to health care is limited. And even when care is available, the drugs used to treat these diseases are old, sometimes they're toxic, and people are developing resistance to them. The quest to develop new drugs for these devastating diseases just got a big boost. In today's issue of the journal Science, an international team of scientists published the genomes of the three parasites that cause these diseases. They hope this will pave the way to new drugs and vaccines. We'll talk now with one of those researchers about this work and the challenges of treating diseases in the developing world. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now I'm very happy to introduce my guest. He's Peter Myler, a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and a research professor in the School of Medicine and the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle. And so naturally, because he works in Seattle, he's joining us today from London, which is the way it always seems to work. But Dr. Myers, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, I'm here in London, so it's a bit weird.
I know, but this is the globe-trotting world of international science, and I suppose London is quite well known for its tropical hygiene research, so perhaps London is the right place to be. You know, as I said as we started, Americans don't really know very much about us. Can you get about these diseases? Can you tell us about African trypanosomiasis, or I guess it's sometimes called African sleeping sickness?
Yes, sleeping sickness is probably one of these diseases that people may have heard of. It's caused by a bite from a tsetse fly, which infects people with Trypanosoma brucei, one of the parasites that we've just sequenced. So basically, if you get bitten by an infected tsetse fly, the parasite will get into your bloodstream, and you'll feel a little bit sick. But in a reasonably high percentage of people, it gets into the central nervous system in the brain, and you get your mood affected, and you get sleepy during the daytime, and then you'll probably die if you're not treated. So fairly nasty disease in Africa, obviously, hence the name African trypanosomiasis.
Okay. And what about, what about Chagas disease? What's that?
Chagas disease is a disease caused by another trypanosome, Trypanosoma cruzi, in Central and Southern America. It's a disease transmitted by the assassin bug, which is a bug that lives in houses and bites people and transmits the parasite to you that way. Initially, most people don't get very sick. They have a little swelling, maybe a bit of fever. But at about 10% of people, 10 or 20 years later, they'll come down with a very nasty swelling of either the heart or the colon or the esophagus. It's actually due to the immune response to the parasite rather than the parasite itself. And then those people quite often will die as well. In fact, it's one of the leading causes of heart disease in the world. About 20 or 30,000 people die from Chagas disease every year.
Wow. Okay, and now the 30-second explanation of leishmaniasis, because we have to go to a break in about a minute.
Okay, well, leishmaniasis is a series of different diseases. You can have one where it causes skin ulcers, and then there's a much worse form where you get an internal infection in the spleen and the liver, and that can be deadly.
All right, that was go ahead. You have another 15
another
seconds.
Mucocutaneous, where you get infected on your mouth and lips, and your face ulcerates away.
Uh-huh. So not good diseases to get.
Definitely
not at all.
Not. And okay. About 100,000, 120,000 people a year die from these diseases. And that may very well be an underestimate because we don't have very good diagnostics.
Okay. Well, we have to take a short break, but we'll be back talking about some new exciting news about the genome sequences of parasitic diseases. Stay with us. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about decoding the DNA of parasite, and my guest is Peter Myler. He's a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and research professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Dr. Myler, now we know a little bit about what these diseases are. What's the advantage of having the genome sequence of these three diseases?
Basically what the advantage of having the genome sequence is, it tells you all of the parts for these organisms, and it'll probably save off every project that we would do as scientists on these projects. It'll probably save about a year's time, because it used to take you a year or two to isolate the gene that you were interested in, and now it takes about one day. You go look it up in a database, you make some primers, and by the next day you have the gene isolated. So that will save a tremendous amount of time. But in addition to that, it also provides us with a large number of potential targets for drugs and vaccines. Now that we know what the genes are, we can make some more intelligent choices of what drugs we might want to use to at least to test.
And why is it that these three diseases, which sound like they have very similar symptoms, why were the three genomes, they seem to have been joined together somehow?
Okay, well, these parasites are all single-cell protozoan parasites, and they fall in the same family. So they're all related evolutionarily, but they did diverge about 200 to 500 million years ago. They have a number of similar aspects. Their molecular biology is a little bit strange, actually. And it turns out that after we've sequenced them and compared their genomes, about three-quarters of the genes each of them has are common to all three. And probably about half of those genes aren't found in any other organisms. So they have a lot of similarities, but obviously since they cause different diseases and they live in different places in the body and they're transmitted by different insects, they have a lot of differences as well.
All right. Well, I'd like to invite our listeners to ask their questions about these diseases, because they really are a major international health threat, and it's actually quite an interesting thing that the high-tech world of genome sequencing is being applied to some of these diseases, which are usually associated with countries that are in a less advanced technological state. Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from Steve in Philadelphia. Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, we're definitely going to...
Hey, Steve, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Yeah, I just had one question. Do you think it's possible that these diseases are more prevalent in Africa because, in general, the black is a smelly, dirty creature?
I think that question was... unnecessary, and I don't think we need to address it. Let's go to James in Boston. James, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi.
Hello, James.
Hi, I've got a question, because one of the things you said is that it's kind of quite rare in the U.S. We were living in New Jersey about 3 or 4 years ago, and we bought a puppy who became ill. He had skin ulcerations and all those kind of things, and we actually moved back to the UK for a year or two. We've now moved out to Boston. But while we were in the UK, the puppy got quite ill, and the vet had no idea what was happening, because it's kind of quite unknown in the UK too. So took a lot of investigation to find out finally that it was leishmaniasis. So I guess my two questions really are: A, is it increasing in prevalence, and are there certain parts or certain climates within the U.S. that are conducive to leishmaniasis? And the second thing is, you know, is there any risk of transmission from animals to humans?
Interesting.
Okay, was your puppy a foxhound?
No, he was a cross between a Bichon Frise and a Cocker Spaniel.
The reason why I asked that, there has been an outbreak in foxhounds in the U.S. Over the last few years, and actually, the last I knew, people didn't really know where the infections were coming from. Now, of course, it is possible that the infection could be transferred from a dog to a human, but for that to happen, you need to have the vector, and the vector is not really present in most of the U.S. You won't just get it, you know, from touching an infected puppy.
Can you explain, Dr. Myler, what you mean by a vector in this case?
A vector is the insect that passes the parasite from one organism to another. So these parasites have to go through an insect vector, as we call it. They don't go directly from one person to another. They have to go through this insect stage.
But we got lots of insects in America. Is there something unique?
They have very specific specific insects that they have to be transmitted through. They can't just use any insect. They have to go through a specific sandfly in the case of Leishmania, and it has to not just be any old sandfly. It has to be a particular type of sandfly.
And just following up from James's question, how would it be that foxhounds, I mean, how would it be an epidemic that would infect only one breed? Would it be that they're more susceptible, or would they be transmitting it from one to another, or mother to puppy, or something like that?
Well, it may be that they're more susceptible, or I don't know that there's any evidence for that. I think that probably it was an outbreak in one or two puppy farms where the dogs were bred, or in foxhounds obviously used for hunting. So they may have just been confined to one or two areas. As far as I know, there wasn't any evidence that had actually been transmitted by sandflies in the U.S. But it is possible, I guess, particularly in the south of the U.S.
Interesting. Well, James, thanks very much for that question.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's take another call now, and how about if we go to Chris in Kansas City? Chris, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering is this more bacterial type of parasites, or are they viral?
Huh, interesting question. Well, maybe none of the above is the right answer. Peter Myler?
Yes, you're correct, Joe. It is none of the above. These are single-celled, but they are protozoa, so they're very simple nucleated organisms, so they're the same sort of group or the same kingdom as humans and yeast, etc., but they're single-celled organisms. So they're more complicated than bacteria and certainly more complicated than viruses.
And, do we know, in some cases, bacteria will secrete some factor that will cause the illness. Do we know how these parasites are actually causing the harm that they cause?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that we know in a great deal of detail. Certainly for Chagas disease, as I said before, a lot of the damage is due to the human immune response to the parasite rather than the parasite itself. African sleeping sickness occurs when the parasite gets into your brain. Leishmania, since there are several different forms of the disease, it can vary from what the damage is. Again, there's a lot of immune interaction going on that can sometimes cause a problem. So I wouldn't say that we have complete understanding, but at least we have some understanding.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for that question.
Okay, thank you.
I wondered, Dr. Myler, can I just, I said at the outset that the drugs that exist for these diseases are not very good. Was that accurate? Are there new drugs?
That is quite accurate, yes. So most of the drugs that are currently used are at least 50 years old, and most of them are based on heavy metals like arsenic and antimony. And in the case of one particular drug called milarsoprol, which is used to treat sleeping sickness, 5% of the patients who are treated die from the drug, rather than from the disease. So, you know, it's only used as a last resort, and they're particularly nasty.
Hmm. All right, let's try another call and go to Jim in North Carolina. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call today.
Sure. Uh-huh.
I had two questions for you, but I've answered one of them myself, so I'll go on to my second question.
Okay.
If I could change the subject just a little bit in a different direction. I'm wondering if your guest knows much about any progress being made to sequence the Lyme disease genome. I'm currently a patient infected with Lyme, and I'm really monitoring the progress being made in the treatments and that type of thing.
Okay, thanks. That's interesting. Dr. Myler, do you know anything about that?
I don't know for certain, but I actually am fairly sure that the Lyme disease virus, bacterium, has already been sequenced.
That was my impression, too, but
yes.
Maybe...
Borrelia burgdorferi, and I believe that's already been sequenced, and perhaps by actually one of the centers that was working with us on this project, the Institute for Genome Research. This project, by the way, the TriTrip project, as we call it, involved 238 people from 47 institutions in 25 countries on all six continents, so... certainly an international collaboration.
Well, but I think it raises the fact that the genome sequence of Lyme disease bacteria might be sequenced, and now that we have these sequences in hand, it raises an interesting question and to my mind, and that is, does this kind of high-tech, you know, really deep understanding of the molecular biology of an organism really, really help you make improvements in treatment? because it seems like there's a long way between the discovery and the treatment.
Yes, there is a long way, and there's a long wait, too. You know, drugs take generally about 10 years to develop, but the genome sequences will provide a place to start, and that otherwise we wouldn't have. And there have been some examples, not very many as yet, where even in the last 5 years, things that have been identified through genome projects are actually now into drugs that are in advanced stages of testing. So I think all of the scientists would agree that the genome projects have certainly been worth the money that they've taken to do the work, and that probably within the next 5 to 10 years we'll have a revolution in new drugs that are coming out. But, you know, these things take time, and they take a lot more money to make drugs than they did to sequence the organisms as well.
Well, our crack staff here at Science Friday has researched the question of whether the genome has been sequenced of the Lyme bacteria, and you were right, it has been. So that was good. We got that straight. But let's take another call now. How about if we go to Chris in Putney, Vermont? Chris, welcome to the program.
My question is, what is a genome? How is it decoded? And at the end of the day, what does decoding the genome actually tell us? And I'll take my question off the air. Thanks.
Chris, you've taken us back to first principles, but that's probably useful. Thanks very much for that. Dr. Myler, what is a genome?
So the genome is basically all of the DNA in a particular organism. And it, when you decode it, it means that you determine the sequence of the nucleotides that make up DNA, and that can tell you what each gene is, and by telling you what is the sequence of the proteins that are made from the genes. And so that, as I said before, really gives you the parts list. It doesn't tell you everything that you need to know about the organism, but it tells you all of the players. So hopefully that's clear enough for everyone.
Yeah. And the parts list is, I mean, is that... It's still a genetic sequence. You have to figure out what these sequences do, essentially.
That's correct. So in the case of the three genomes that we just reported here, about 40% of the genes, we don't really know what they do. 60%, we have perhaps 40 or 50%, we have a pretty good idea of what they do because they're similar to proteins that have been studied in other organisms. But about 40%, we have absolutely no idea what they do. And that's going to keep scientists busy for, you know, a long time yet.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Myler about the recent papers, I guess today's papers, published in the journal Science, describing the sequence of three parasites that cause parasitic disease. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're also interested in hearing from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Are these diseases, these parasitic diseases, are they exacerbated or made worse by, combinations with other diseases like AIDS or tuberculosis?
Certainly there is an interaction between HIV and HIV-AIDS and leishmaniasis, and because both of them actually infect the immune cells. And so, yes, I think it's pretty clear that there would be exacerbation with multiple infections. And in fact, in the developing countries, this is probably a real problem because there are lots of diseases, and they probably, if there were just one of them, it wouldn't be nearly as bad as if you were infected with several. But we don't really know a lot about that yet.
Okay. Let's take another call. How about this time from Jill in San Antonio, Texas? Jill, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi, Jill.
I have a question about current diagnostic methods available. I trained, I'm a medical technologist, and I trained back in the late 50s, and I also did my postgraduate training in New Orleans at Charity Hospital, and there was a lot of tropical medicine studies being done, so we did indeed do a lot of diagnosis by microscopy, and I was just wondering if there are any immunologic tests available now.
These
organisms, the diagnostic tests are not all that good. There are some immunological tests that are available. I'm not convinced that they're all that reliable just at the moment. And in fact, the sort of gold standard is microscopy or even more, actually growing the organisms in culture. So diagnostics, I think, will be one of the first things that comes out of these genome projects. We should see, perhaps within 5 years, some many better diagnostics than they're currently available.
Do you think they will be immunologic then, basically?
Some of them will. There are problems with that. The problem with an immunological-based test is that it can tell you that you've had the exposure to the organism at some stage, but it can't tell you whether you currently have it or not.
Ah, I see. Yes, that's right.
So that's good in one sense, but it's not good in another sense, because some of these diseases, you know, you can have had it years ago, and it won't affect you.
Right, it has resolved itself. So what is the direction of the diagnostic?
There are two directions. One is the immunological, and the other is to try to detect the parasite DNA or parasite proteins.
I see.
Jill, thanks very much for that call. A very interesting topic. I just wonder, Dr. Myler, you know, we talked about these diseases affecting poorer countries, and of course the research for biomedical research is kind of expensive. How do you, who pays for the research on these important diseases, and how do you get a drug company interested in making a product?
Well, the research for the genome stuff, which cost about $32 million over the last 10 years, was provided by the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. and by the Wellcome Trust in the U.K. and the Burroughs Wellcome Fund in the U.S. and some money from WHO, so a variety of sources. Now, in terms of what to do next, we're going to need a lot more than $30 million. And you're correct. So far, the biotech companies and the drug companies have not really been forthcoming. So we're going to rely, hopefully, on some funds from foundations such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, from governments, from NGOs. And hopefully the drug companies can help, if not with money, by giving us expertise, access to their drugs, that type of stuff. So I think what we need to do is build it from a variety of sources in sort of a big consortium.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you very much for joining me today. Dr. Peter Myler is member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and research professor in the School of Medicine and the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle. He joined us from London. When we come back from a short break, we'll look at Project BioShield, a project to protect us against a bioterrorist attack. Stay with us.